This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Okay, we're talking about America's polarized politics, and it's something I've increasingly struggled with, watching happen, getting worse, and feeling very impotent to do much about it. And particularly as that polarization is interacting with evangelical Protestantism, I've cast about for ways to understand it, what's happening. Has America lost its story? Where is a moral compass? I've wanted to ask, if we can have any voice, what should we be saying into this scene? In the midst of this, the term evangelical, or the word evangelical, has become weaponized, as they say, because now, even more than before, it's seen as, in many circles, and many times when we hear it on the news, as a voting bloc, more than a theological or spiritual designation, which is what I'm used to. My question is that for those Christians who believe the Bible in a thoughtful way, what could we be doing or saying over the long term to help heal this disunity, knowing that the voice of Christians and the action of Christians has been part of this disunity? David Brooks wrote that society has, quote, become a free-form demolition derby of moral confrontation. So you know what he thinks. Jonathan Haidt, who I'll be looking at quite a lot tonight, writes that our political life is, quote, polarized and embattled to the point of dysfunction, unquote. I remember Francis Schaeffer saying a number of times that democracy is a wonderful form of government, but it is a workable form of government as long as there's a sufficient consensus in the population. Without that consensus, it will stumble, grind to a halt, and turn into something more authoritarian. I've heard more talk about democracy being in danger in the last 2 years than any other time I can remember in my life. And it's on those, it's exactly in those areas. So, in this lecture, I'm not going to attempt some sort of a solution or Christian blueprint for political action or even thought, nor even give a history to an enormously complex thing. If we were to look at, try and understand the history of polarization politically in this country, it would be enormously complicated. But I do want to look at some of the philosophical and theological backgrounds, threads in the background, that make me want to ask a question at the end. How can those who believe the Bible in a thoughtful way speak into this in a way that will be more helpful rather than less helpful? So maybe I'm trying to lower your expectations of what I'm trying to do in this lecture, but to do much more than this would be pretty naive. I'm not sure I have achieved this, but I've read an enormous amount keying into this, and there's just an enormous amount that I'm not going to say, don't have the time to talk about. But a certain book has been interesting to me, not because I agree with it necessarily, in all areas, but it started me thinking. You got seats back there? Oh, good. Some seats up in the front, if anyone can wants to risk that. I'm going to start with looking at a social psychologist called Jonathan Haidt. It's spelled H-A-I-D-T. He wrote a book some 5 years ago called The Righteous Mind. Some of you may have come across that. The subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. So I realized when I saw the subtitle, he's tracking on the whole thing that concerns me in a number of ways. Published 5 years ago and achieved a lot of attention for all sorts of different reasons. It's especially interesting to me because of our topic of polarization in America. I'm using him because he's looking at he's a lot of analysis of America, but it's in the backdrop of a sweep of his analysis of a transcultural analysis of moral foundations throughout the world. What are the moral foundations that people think morally in all sorts of different cultural frameworks, religious frameworks, and so forth? He's an atheist from a Jewish background, politically well on the left, embraces evolutionary psychology as his methodology, but looks at American polarization, at these two sides shouting at each other at full volume, and has some very interesting thoughts about it. I'll start with my own sort of, that's the outline, but I want to skip that for a minute and I'll go back to the outline. I want to look at what he calls moral foundations. Here he's looking transculturally. On the left side, you'll see, the first line is autonomy, community, divinity. Those are the foundations of moral reflection, of moral obligation. Beneath each one, you'll see a moral opposition, or two moral oppositions. Under autonomy on the left, you'll see care versus harm and fairness versus cheating. Under community in the middle, you'll see loyalty versus betrayal, authority versus subversion. On the right, you'll see moral foundation of divinity, and there it's sacred versus profane. I'll start right in here, and then I'll back up and give you the outline of the whole talk. Starting with autonomy, the ethic of autonomy is the foundation that he sees as basically dominant in academic European and North American culture. When you study ethics, study morality, this is what you get, is basically this framework. It's that educated, secular society believes and teaches. The word autonomy simply means self-law, autonomos. It's based on the idea that people are autonomous individuals. There's no necessarily authority over them. They make up their mind for themselves, what they believe, what they want to do. But they come with individual desires, needs, and preferences. Here, the ethics of autonomy include harm done to other people to constrict or deny those freedoms, or hurt done to them directly, or cheating them in some way, shape, or form. All those are seen to be wrong as over and against care and fairness. Care and harm, care versus harm, care particularly for the innocent and the powerless to help themselves. Very basic concern is a care for the poor and for minorities less able to help themselves. Help them care for freedom and opportunity to prevent harm to themselves, to limit or the limiting of their rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And for them to also have medical care, education, economic justice, and so on. Fairness and cheating Here there are two distinct versions of fairness and cheating. The political left sees fairness and cheating in terms of social justice issues, that for those who have been left out need to be brought in, those who are oppressed, treated unfairly by individuals or systemically by society, by the system, the disempowered, so don't have a shot at equal opportunity with the rest of society, who have been treated unfairly. You can think of the voice of the left responding to the Republican tax reform, which benefits big business and the top 1% of the income distribution, and they say unfair, and want to protest against this from this ethical foundation. On the political right, on the other hand, fairness is apt to mean that commitment on the political right as well, but they also mean by it what's called a fairness of proportionality, meaning that the rewards of society ought to go proportionally to those who deserve them, those who've earned them, not to those who don't work, who cheat the system, and who are free riders. So if I'm on this side, I don't want my tax money to go to the laziest people in the society or to illegal immigrants. Fairness is a fairness of proportion. Moving across, community, ethics of community, or the moral foundation of community. Moral foundations of community are grounded in somewhat different assumptions, mainly that moral obligations don't just have to do with the freedom of expression of individuals within society, but have to do with the success and viability of groups, which are also necessary in society, necessary actually for the survival of the individual. So looking at the group, groups such as families, teams, companies, tribes, and nations, which are each more than just the sum of the individuals that make them up. Groups are entities in themselves, which are held together only by community moral obligations. Now, that's an important issue. What holds communities together are moral obligations that tie them, that bring those communities together. Care versus harm, or fairness and versus cheating on this side, don't do anything to hold community groups together. You need moral values that encourage belonging, and not taking off, but being part of something and sticking with something and staying with it. So there would be a moral opposition between loyalty versus betrayal, which holds in Haidt's idea smaller groups together, like marriage and family. You need a deep sense of loyalty as over and against betrayal to keep a marriage together, to hold a family together, to hold a team together, a coalition, a company. What troubles scholars is to figure out what holds a non-kinship bond together. They can understand what makes a kinship bond hold together by the biological connections of marriage and family, or family and children. But what holds groups together that are not held together by kinship? And there's all sorts of theories on this, and a great mystery, because we want to know, we need to know how to do it, but that's apt to be a big question, especially at a time when small groups and associations are under fire and deeply undermined by the structures of modern society. But if you don't have loyalty, social groups come apart and don't function as they're meant to function for society as a whole. Disloyalty, betrayal, treachery is seen as morally bad and evil, maybe sometimes even worthy of punishment. Then he would put another opposition of authority versus subversion under community, and this thinks that you need an extra category here to deal with larger groups as opposed to the smaller groups like family, teams, and so forth. Larger groups, wider categories like nations, cities, armies. If a nation or any large political institution is to hold together, there must be a willingness to accept and obey certain rules, customs, maybe obligations, and have respect and be willing to sacrifice for the common good to hold this together. This is true at all levels of society. You must make sacrifices for these larger groups, for this Commonwealth of Massachusetts, for the U.S. of A. We all, in being part of that, if we're part of that, make sacrifices to make this work. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a nation. Example from Switzerland has been sort of amusing to me as an illustration because it's so different from what we see in America. We think of Switzerland, yes, it's Western Europe, it's more or less like we are in America, but not really quite, because I think that the ethics of the community are a little bit different, a little bit stronger in ways that surprise us. For example, a cousin of mine worked for a computer company in Geneva, heading up the software in this company there. He brought a couple over from America to live in Geneva there with him. They had a gun department and a big apartment building, nice apartment building in Geneva. But they put their laundry, you know, in Switzerland, everybody has a balcony because the view is beautiful and the air is good and so on. You need to have the air. But they hung their laundry on the balcony. They had a note under the door after the first day that they'd done that and said, don't do this. They said, a typical American response, who is uptight here? Somebody's being uptight. So they did it the next day too. Another note under the door saying, don't do this. And they gave it a few days off. But then they did it again. The third note that came under the door, it says, you have not complied. Your work permit is terminated, and you have a week to get out of the country. Now, the computer company that had brought them all the way over from the States, replaced them and so on, went berserk, went to Bern to try and untangle things. No good. Couldn't do any good. It was too late. It was done. So, now, basically they're just saying, it's fine that you're here, but if you don't play by the rules, we really don't want you here. And you're out. Which, they had to leave. And everybody was aggrieved, and it cost them a mess of money, everybody. But imagine explaining why you're suddenly home. Anyway, that's all things we don't need to solve. But at a higher level, of course, patriotism for the nation, for a nation to last, there must be real patriotism, loyalty to one's country, to pay taxes, and even committed even to the point of being willing to die in military service for that country. That's pretty up there in terms of loyalty. The opposite of patriotism is treason, which is punished with the greatest severity. Most people in this country, even those who may not think of themselves as great patriots, would probably not use an American flag as a rag to wipe up something off the floor. Okay? Probably not. Now, is that a moral issue? I'm asking you here. It's not a moral issue. Anyone think it is a moral issue? What?
I think it is.
Yeah. You think it's a moral issue? Yeah. Okay, well, that's something we can disagree about. If you think it's a moral issue, you're checking on... It's not cheating anybody of anything. It's not hurting anybody. But you're drawing on the ethics of the morality of community. It's against the ethics of community, which means you want to take those ethics seriously. I would not do it. And I guess there is a moral component to that. But that's... just to give you an idea of what the difference, there's a qualitative difference between these different foundations. It has nothing to do with cheating anybody, but it can be understood as a moral reality. It's not a moral issue in the sense that it's a sin and it's one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not use your flag as a rag. But it gives you, it is a certain disrespect of a nation that most of us feel who may be U.S. citizens, we have certain things to be grateful for. Moving on, the third the moral foundation of divinity. Very powerful moral obligations are rooted in religious views of reality. Here I'm going to leave Jonathan Haidt and do this section more on my own, in a way to make this more applicable to the question we're looking at this evening. The opposition here, the most basic opposition, is for or against God. I've called it sacred versus profane. Here, as in the morality of community, there's more to this moral framework than just harm and fairness, and more to it than community. For example, one of the main things that you pick up as you read, for example, the Ten Commandments, is that you're not meant to treat God as an idol. That doesn't hurt anybody necessarily, and it doesn't violate community in any way that you can see. It just is a violation of God to treat God as an idol, or to have an idol instead of God. That's a high level wrong that violates who God is. So God is personal. He's created us in His image and likeness, and that we would know Him and image Him by the way we live. What is sacred is God Himself is sacred, but also His creation, particularly that He values human beings made in His image, that He treats as sacred, have a great value, to be valued and treated as precious. And what is sacred also is the way He's told us to live, the way He's told us to treat each other, to follow His laws for our lives. He's told us a great deal about how to live a sacred or righteous life on this earth. Those instructions have to do with all across the board, how we behave in community, how we behave in each other with respect to care and harm and so forth. So the commands that come out of divinity go immediately straight across the whole thing. They're not restricted to some sort of religious behavior. This is talking about the Christian faith. I'm not talking about religion in general. And I don't want to get into some generic religious discussion because that's much more confusing. What is profane is anything that is against God or God's ways, denying His authority, His will. What is profane is sin, disobedience to God, not only in the religious areas of life, but in any areas of life where He's spoken and given us direction. Political life, economic life, our working life, church life, family life, science, entertainment, the whole business is subject to His will. And again, I've just described a Christian view, not everybody's view. Part of this whole system is that He's shown us a way for redemption and forgiveness when we fall short of righteousness unsacred in the way we've lived. Okay, these are three human moral foundations. I'll go back to my outline here for a minute. We're down there at the beginning of just about to go into Roman numeral 2 here. There are three moral foundations. They overlap, but there's a qualitative difference between them. Jonathan Haidt's book is called The Righteous Mind, and his point is that the righteous mind is focused on all of these moral foundations, not just stuck on one. He says that evolution has produced them all. He's an evolutionary psychologist, so he believes that evolution has produced not just our morphology, our physical form, but the way we think, the way we feel, the way we work. I'm not going to get into this tonight, but I'm just telling you where he's coming from. So evolution has produced them simply because they were adaptive. That's the only reason evolution produces anything. And they still are adaptive. Though an atheist, he believes that all three foundations were there because they needed to be there for society to flourish, and they still are necessary for society to flourish. He's very critical. He trashes Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, and all the atheist visionaries because he thinks they're doing lousy science. They don't appreciate evolution, which has so created a vast wealth of religious phenomena in the world because it works, because it's all adaptive. And they, like Hitchens, would say, religion poisons everything. He says, how can you say that and appreciate the science of evolutionary theory? I don't want to go down very far down that road either, but this is an interesting way that he separates himself very clearly from Dawkins et co., from those missionary atheists. What happens is we look at polarization in modern life. I want to give you something of the background of this moral polarization, looking at first the background of the left and then the background of the right. And here I'm going really fast over what could take a long, long time, okay? Yes?
Height.
Height. H-A-I-D-T. And he pronounces it height.
In the book again, it's what?
The Righteous Mind. Background to the left. If we go to the early Enlightenment, you run into people like Hobbes and Locke and later Rousseau, who talk about the state of nature. They envisage it each somewhat differently from each other, but for all of them, it's sort of a primal imaginative myth that none of them believe really was there historically, but it's sort of as if they imagine an early hunter-gatherer society, if they even knew that much. This is what it must have been like back then, maybe. It's something they play with and they do in different ways, very, very, quite different from each other. Hobbes is very grim. Rousseau, much more sunny. But the idea is that in the state of nature, there's the individual alone. The state of nature, because it's nature, is pre-society and pre-political. So before there's any society, any politics or anything that would change human functioning, human feeling, human experience. But just, I guess, the hunter-gatherer wandering in the woods with the occasional sexual encounter, whatever, feeding himself, going it alone. You don't get a sense that they really believe that this was something you can look back to as historical. But the big thing is freedom. He was free from everybody's claims on him. Nobody had a claim on him. He could do what he wants when he wanted to do it. The idea of the state of nature forms a little imaginative narrative which has actually had great power on the anthropology of the Enlightenment. If that's what you think, how people began this way, that can change the way you think of human experience. Great effect, even long after people stopped using the term, because not many people after Rousseau used it, but I think it sort of left a residual residue in people's minds. Rousseau did more with it, perhaps, in the next century, in the 18th century. His famous phrase, man is born free but everywhere in chains, illustrates this, where even a child, because it's like the child's in a state of nature, but before the child is affected by society, but the minute he's affected by society, he's in chains. And society surrounds him, and he's affected by society, and warped and inhibited and bent by society. And greater freedom would lead to greater flourishing. Way later, I have to throw this in, but I don't want to get derailed on it. Freud, though he didn't use a state of nature idea at all, nonetheless tapped into the same thing by saying that it is our civilization that causes us our neurosis. If we just were limited to our sort of animal self and the expectations of an animal or someone living as if in the state of nature, we wouldn't have all the neuroses that we have now that we have society and we have all sorts of rules that we have to obey in order to, for society to hold together, to get along with each other, to have commitments to each other that hold. And so he says the more advanced society gets, the more neurotic we'll become. Because society is against somehow this solitary individual, which is who we really are. So the flaws, if the flaws we see in ourselves come from society, as Rousseau would say, not from the human heart, then it's an invitation to believe that we can engineer human society to bring utopian visions into reality in society. If the problems are in society, we can tweak society because it's out there for us to tinker with, as long as it's not in the human heart itself. Later you have Kant's ethics, with his huge emphasis on human autonomy. We have we're under the authority only of the moral rules that we set for ourselves. We must obey moral rules, but they're moral rules that we determine for ourselves, as long as we decide them the way he instructed us to decide those moral rules. He protects himself in a way, but his influence is huge on modern moral theory, on modern ethical theory, of autonomy. There's nobody telling us what's right and wrong. Jonathan Haidt's spokesperson for the liberal side is John Stuart Mill. His focus is on the autonomy foundation of morality. It majors on individual freedom, the focus on social and economic fairness, especially to marginalized groups. Mill is a utilitarian, is also inspired confidence that we can engineer society to work differently than it does, for the greater good of the greatest number. We can go to work on restructuring society to make it work out and do something much better than it ever than ever happened under the church's direction or anything primitive like that. So people have basically a good heart and behave well if they're given adequate freedom. So their freedom as autonomous individuals to enjoy full human rights without interference is central to Mill and to those who follow him. So the left down to today, his emphasis has been on economically and socially marginalized groups and their rights to improve them. Also for the freedom of the autonomous individual in terms of behavior, to express his or her free choices as long as you don't hurt somebody, as long as you don't interfere with their freedom. So Jonathan Haidt claims that the left-leaning moral thinking of our academic Western society is focused mainly on these ideas of care and fairness under autonomy, under this left side. His whole critique here is that the vast majority of political ethics as taught have to do with are drawing on this one foundation. And focused in, almost entirely in care and fairness, with the emphasis on economic fairness. He went to Yale, then went to University of Pennsylvania, and then did his went to the University of Chicago for postdoctoral work. And he found, he's sort of interesting, he says, and my perspective, which was just what I've described to you, was never challenged in any of those three universities. This is what was taught as the gospel truth. This is the way everybody understands it. This is the way it is. And I accepted it without a question. At that point, in that frame of mind, he says, I couldn't see political conservatives as having moral convictions at all. He explained that they were, he understood them as being psychologically deprived in their upbringing, overly protected by rigid parents in a climate of fear. And that's how they turned out to be conservative in their political views and economic views. But for his postdoctoral work at the University of Chicago, they told him to go and spend 3 months in India, which he ended up living with Hindus, studying and studying there, the way they were living, in intensely religiously grounded, morally motivated way of life. In other words, they were people who were really drawing on the ethics of divinity, the morality of divinity, and that was steering their life. Giving up the individual freedoms that the average American would not dream of giving up. Willingly giving them up. Arranged marriages? You've got to be kidding. Now, in other words, willingly going into arranged marriages as being and believing that's the best thing for them. And he says, what? Having grown up in this country, having grown up with this, the framework that he's grown up with, willingly accepting the high importance of honor within the family. No way. Couldn't understand this. But began to understand that actually they are very happy doing it. Actually, a lot of them have better marriages than I've seen around me in America, even though were arranged marriages, and that it works for them. There were parts of that that he didn't like so much, but he was shaken and realized, I've been looking only on this one side, and the whole tradition I've grown up in has all been on this one side, and not even looked at these having anything to do with morality at all. So that's his background coming into this. I'll go on a bit more with where he's come down to. The background of the right. Here, I'll go back again here. Oops. Again, I'm going to depart from him by giving a bit of what I think is he references without knowing it, where the left has a sort of primal story, as if creation story with the state of nature. Anything to do with Judeo-Christianity has also a creation story in Genesis 1-3 of Adam and Eve and the fall. And I think that has a profound effect on all of this. In this story, Adam and Eve were created perfect, made in God's image, working in harmony together. It's not a story of a solitary individual. It's a social beginning, because it was not good that man is alone. Almost immediately, it was not good that man is alone. A woman was created. The story is not about the first individual, or even about the first marriage. It's about the beginning of human society. Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is the beginning of human society itself. Human beings are social beginnings from their creation on. You then have the fall, rebellion against God. They have to leave the garden, but they take their sin with them. One son kills another, starts up a train of terrible relationships and events. You go on through in the book of Genesis. You follow the story. Eventually, laws are given by God, telling the Jewish people how to flourish and be free, not by just expressing their desires, as the state of nature would have said, but by resisting their sin, and then having freedom as a result of resisting some of their desires. It tells them how to prosper and have freedom by reining in illegitimate demands for freedom. It's how to make community, even in the midst of social destructiveness and selfishness and so on, and have that community able to last. Emile Durkheim as his spokesperson for the right. Not that he really has anything to do with it, much to do with the American political right now, but he's a French sociologist living at the turn of into the 20th century. His Jewish background, that he, I don't know how much he's taking in any way consciously by the story I've just told, but deeply influenced by the Enlightenment, but also he somehow has brought along with him something from the biblical tradition. He saw the individual, human individual, as not intrinsically kind-hearted, but possessing a selfishness which made him dangerous in society. Society must somehow be able to restrain these destructive attitudes and behavior. And for that, one needs social institutions that are strong, not just in applying force, but in inspiring loyalty, belonging, and willing self-sacrifice. Do you see what I'm saying here? society must be able to provide the willingness to make sacrifices to be part of it, to want to do that. It must be offering something attractive to individuals. To do that, a society needs to have aims and values that were higher than individual freedom and pleasure, so that people would know it was worth sacrificing their autonomy to be part of this, for these values. He saw the great importance, and this is his distinctiveness here, an enormous importance of religion in society to provide the framework and understanding to make this happen. He's a very famous statement, says, man cannot become attached to higher aims and submit to a rule if he sees nothing above him to which he belongs. I want to read that again. Man cannot become attached to higher aims and submit to a rule if he sees nothing above him to which he belongs. He's calling for sacred meanings, purposes in life, without which a society will not hold together at the large level. Without a higher meaning system, you will have what he called, and he's the one that coined this term, anomie, which is a sense of boredom and disengagement coming from normlessness, absence of purpose, absence of meaning. It happens when a society no longer has a shared moral order, a shared sense of purpose, which Durkheim saw in his own research resulted in depression and suicide in many of the people he was dealing with as a scientist. He coined the term moral capital, which you may have picked up all over the place. Francis Schaeffer used this term. I don't know whether he ever credited Durkheim with it. But much of Schaeffer's work was showing how the Christian faith provides moral capital for people to want to live right in this world. By moral capital, it means you need the ideas and also loyalty to those and to the way of life that's held in those ideas that you've seen demonstrated for you. It's not just a bunch of propositions, but it's just ideas that have been part of a way of life that you've observed, make up moral capital, which make up people wanting to live for the way life is lived in a certain place, in a certain country, or whatever. Haidt's surprising theme that got him an enormous amount of pushback after he first wrote the book was that, remember, he's way on the left politically himself. He claimed that conservatives, the right, has done much better at understanding the moral psychology of America than the left has, than the liberals have. He says the liberals have majored only on this left side of ethics of care and harm, and reduce that mostly to economics. And his point is that and the left turning to these two moral foundations, that the right in its rhetoric and way it campaigns and presents itself is appealing to all five of the different moral oppositions. By the right, he doesn't mean the Republicans. He hates the Republicans, or the Republicans that are functioning today, but he means the serious conservative thinkers of the past and behind them. He would start with Edmund Burke and go on up. But he says the Republicans today have learned from them. The left appeals only to autonomous freedom of the individual and economic fairness. Issues of harm and fairness, but the right connects to those, but also to group loyalties, to patriotism, to support of the military, to the police, and since Ronald Reagan, family values and religious freedom. You see, that's a much wider approach, which covers all three of his moral foundation stones. And this is much to his frustration. That's why the right has won more elections, he says. So he got all sorts of pushback from the left on this. He writes, actually, this is written when Kerry was running against Bush, and he despairs of the rhetoric that Kerry's speechwriters use, and he rewrites his speeches to say how he should have written them. But he writes them to himself. He doesn't get them off to Kerry. Okay. Friction meaning the content of polarization. Here I'm going to be ridiculously brief because we could go on all night and into the morning till breakfast cataloging the nature of the oppositions of left-right polarization. So I'm not making any attempt to be complete at all, but just to be just examples that have struck me. I remember years ago Barry Segrin, who some of us know, who he and his wife helped us begin this work, coming here in 1979. He used to say, looking at the polarization that he observed there, then that the left sees the main problem to worry about as the greed of those with wealth and power. That's what we need to worry about, the left. Those with wealth and power are greedy and they'll do enormous damage. The right maintains that the problem we need to worry about, on the other hand, is sloth and laziness of people who want handouts and a free ride. That's what the right worries about. If he, insofar as he's right, you have to say that there could be very little communication between those two sides. If they both are dug in, you could easily go a long time without having much connection. Haidt sees the wisdom of Durkheim. He says he calls himself a Durkheimian because of his emphasis on the group, on community morality, and the total need for groups of all different sizes and natures for the good of the individual. And I would add, for the moral development of the individual, which the state is very bad. We need much smaller groups in which we can learn moral reality. But his favorite target here, on the liberal side, that he trashes at least three or four times in the book, is John Lennon's story, Imagine. So I have to read the lyrics of John Lennon's story, Imagine, for you, because this is what represents his own side completely missing the boat and misunderstanding moral and political reality. It goes like this. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Now, so what he's looking at there is an individual with no connecting groups, no nation, no national boundaries, no countries, no religion, but just an individual alone in bliss. No organizations, no institutions, but yet somehow he's thriving, as if he could construct some sort of a state of nature utopia. But Haidt just blasts this backwards and forwards, saying how absolutely naive it is to the role of groups in the health of the individual and the desperate need of groups to be functional and well. Of course, you can see the polarization between left and right everywhere. I think, to take sexual ethics. If you only think in terms of the ethics of autonomy, why not have sex with any consenting partner? Give the kids condoms to prevent them from the harm of STDs and unwanted pregnancies. No harm or unfairness is done if you have safe, consensual sex. So what could be wrong with that? If the human body is basically a playground and there's nothing sacred about it, can do anything you want with it, and they're right. That's right, if that's true. It's somehow very small-minded to think of restricting that, if that's all that's involved. If, on the other hand, there are moral obligations of community or of divinity, there are other whole areas of moral reality that, to care about, to think about, to struggle with, as well as the consequences of longer term that you might not be likely to consider on the short term. Liberal stereotypes of conservatives. Liberals see conservatives as self-satisfied, isolated from poverty, connected mainly to the interests of big business, the military, without empathy or compassion, and they are likely to be evangelical Christians. They fail at both caring and fairness. Again, look at the Republican tax, quote, reform, which gives the benefits to big business in the top 1% of the popular income distribution. The left...
Which tax reform proposal are you discussing?
Yes. Okay. I'm just echoing what I hear on the news, coming from the left. I don't pretend to understand any of them at any depth. The left sees conservatives' convenient belief in Adam Smith's invisible hand, which they think will take the accumulation of wealth motivated by greed and transform it into social benefit as it trickles down to the whole rest of the population. They think, as I think Jack Kennedy said, the high tide will raise all boats. I heard on the radio this couple of weeks ago, no, not all boats. High tide raises just the yachts. So that would be the liberal side questioning trickle-down economics. Just the yachts. They see the right as completely irresponsible when it comes to the environment and the life and death issues of climate change. They also see the loyalties and traditions espoused by conservatives to be, many of them, immoral, in that loyalties and traditions tend to resist efforts to bring justice and needed reform. After all, slavery was a very deep tradition, which was pretty difficult to get rid of. Loyalty to one's race and way of life surrounding racial issues was a vicious force of racism and exclusion. Sexism was and still is an entrenched tradition, whether it be the husband's right to beat his wife that was legal up until late 19th century, or the prohibition of women from owning property, inheriting property, and even to vote for a period of time. So they're just saying, watch out for traditions and loyalties. They can be can attach people to all sorts of things that shouldn't be held onto so tightly, and they can resist reform and change, which to me is a very interesting, is an important concern. We'll pick that up in a minute. Conservative stereotypes of liberals, and I'm not trying to have equal balance here of all things. Conservatives see liberals as out of touch with real life also. They return the compliment. Trying to help the disadvantaged, but overconfident that their ability to do social and economic engineering actually helps, rather than spending vast amounts of money by perhaps making things worse. With concern for a kind of economic inequality that they think they can fix, they are naive about the idea of moral capital, which they dismiss, and can weaken the very institutions of society that might have helped. An example that's often given, I think it was brought up first by Daniel Moynihan, and this is actually raised by Jonathan Haidt himself, in a desire to help inner-city poor, there was a welfare program for single mothers, which gave single mothers financial help, but it turned out to function as a disincentive to marriage, because if you were married, you didn't get any benefits. So it disincentivized marriage, and in the black community, it really disincentivized marriage and was very destructive for undoing the commitment to marriage that had been there. So there, in conservative eyes, failing in caring and fairness through ignoring the wider areas of moral obligation, social meaning, and teaching of the great government all nanny, which takes away human agency and teaches dependency. So you could go on and on both sides and go on with all sorts of criticisms of these. I want to turn then to look at biblical morality. I want to look at the teaching of the Bible in the light of these moral foundations that we've looked at. An obvious place to start would be the Ten Commandments. And you notice when you read them and you take them seriously, especially with some of the things I've been talking about, they're not just a list of do's and don'ts to individuals. The Ten Commandments are oriented toward how you are going to live together and be families and neighbors with each other in this new land where God is sending you. It actually starts with, I have brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And afterwards it says, and if you keep this, keep these rules, you will last in your freedom and not be enslaved again. So it's everything, how you can function as a nation and preserve what I've given you, the freedoms that I've given you. It's very socially oriented. So you could think of, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Second, you're not to make yourself an idol. Third, you should not take God's name in vain. Fourth, remember the Sabbath day. Fifth, honor your father and mother. You'll live longer. You shall not murder. Seventh, you shall not commit adultery. Eight, you shall not steal. Nine, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And finally, 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, wife, servants, property, or anything. Now, as you think of these, it's intriguing. And I want to go back and look at our foundations again. Because it all starts with the ethics of divinity. The first three commandments have everything to do with God defining himself, identifying himself, defining himself, telling you how to get him right. Directly about God himself. I've just brought you out of slavery, I made you, so don't you make something with your hands and call it God. You know, that is the absolute absurdity, because I made you. I am your God and made you. Get God right. The first three commandments are get God right at the beginning, and this will make all the difference. And again, having to do particularly with idolatry, and don't mess up his name, the third commandment. Don't make his name something empty and vain. Don't use it as an empty word, a blasphemy, as swearing. Most people use it as punctuation. You need an exclamation point in the conversation. So, you use God, Christ, whatever, to give it an exclamation point in your conversation. His name is sacred. We get real grounding on how to begin on what we've called moral capital. If you ground yourself in God, in His name, in who He is and who He is not, and how we are to relate to Him. And so he's making the moral capital. He's beginning with the foundation stones of moral capital there. Think of the Lord's Prayer, for example. What is the first petition in the Lord's Prayers? Hallowed be thy name. Again, the name of God. Get that right. Don't mess up there. You want to take a stand there and have everything rest on that. I think it's important that God, stands. This is the importance of his name, that God stands over our loyalties and traditions. You can't say that loyalties and traditions are good, just generically or intrinsically good. They are not. Some are good, some are bad. Some are desperately bad. Some are wonderfully good. But God stands over them and measures them and will show us where they're really wrong. So we should never just embrace tradition or loyalty. Many of them will embrace idols and idolatry, or God substitutes. So loyalties and traditions are necessary, but very dangerous when they find their way into our moral capital when they're wrong. For example, Martin Luther King Jr. used God's word against the deep traditions of race in the American South. He used everything he could get in the Bible to confront the racist traditions of the South in the Jim Crow whole reality of assumptions, in order to bring reform that was bringing life closer to what is pleasing to God. The Roman Catholic Church got loyalty wrong in their sex abuse scandal, with greater loyalty to fellow priests than to the children of their congregations. Again, loyalty, it's wonderful to observe, you should respect it, sort of, but watch out where it's there, because it can be misplaced to tremendous destruction. So we need to be totally committed to a biblical teaching on these issues, to a critical biblical analysis of our loyalties, of our traditions. Just because they're long and have been around us and because they may stimulate nostalgia doesn't mean they're right. The Sabbath, vast amount to say about how you work, how you have others work for you, how you see your time, how you care for yourself, how you care for your family and your neighbor and your animals and the land. This deals with all three foundations, all connected just to Sabbath observance. Honor your father and mother deals with the sacredness of family and marriage. Huge investment in loyalty to the family. But under God, but again, it's important that under God, family is not God. God is God. The family is not God. Family can become God very, very easily in a way that's tremendously destructive. The family is the most basic and necessary building block of society itself, but it isn't God. The commandments against murder and stealing are against the ultimate in both the harm and the unfairness poles of moral foundation of autonomy here. Physical and economic injustice to take away from someone their life itself or what rightfully belongs to them. Those are the maximum violations here care and fairness. Commandment against false witness lifts up the sacredness of truth and truth-telling, absolutely necessary for society to hold together, tell the truth to each other as we stand before God. Someone who doesn't tell the truth simply destroys community and is a terrible neighbor. Finally, the 10th commandment is against coveting. And here again, this is both to do with our standing before God. If I covet, then what he has given to me is not enough, is inadequate. So I covet something else that I could get a hold of that I don't have. So I'm not at peace with God because I'm coveting. And it's a terrible scourge in human society to see coveting getting into our jealousy and envy of one another. As it gets loose in human society, it does terrible work there. There's warning about all the list of things that people should not covet. He starts, it's interesting, your neighbor's wife, his house, his land, his maidservant, manservant, maidservant, donkey, then finally anything of your neighbor's. Just, it's not these things specific, but anything. Don't covet anything. His gifts, his whatever. Not coveting has a huge role in protecting community. Because it can undo it from within, it can undo it from deep attitudes. So it's intriguing to me that just the Ten Commandments itself covers this whole range of moral foundations in a very suggestive, very deep way. But I can't go on just limited to the Ten Commandments, sort of, and I just footnote the whole rest of the Bible here, which I won't read you. I'll just touch on it. Two things. One, Genesis 1 and 2, there's clear the ethics of creation care. Adam and Eve are stewards of the rest of creation. We're meant to care for creation. It's what we would call creation care today, environmental care. Responsible to care over the animal world and over the rest of creation itself. Second point here that I can't get along without raising is the prophets are unbelievably powerful, particularly in this area, not just what you see a lot of is in this first area, how you mistreat people, how you're unfair to people. And their exposure and their condemnation of injustice and unfairness to other human beings. It's important to notice how they judge society. It's always how are the poor treated, the marginalized, the people without power. It's not as if the rich and powerful don't matter to God or are less valuable to God, but because the rich and powerful have ways of taking care of themselves and you don't need to worry about them so much. But it is that those who are without resources, the way you find out whether people really respect God or not is how they treat the disempowered, how they treat people just because they're made in the image of God and of value. So you have great emphasis on the poor, the powerless, the widow, the orphan, the fatherless, the sojourner. We would call that the refugee. I love the verse in Jeremiah 22:16. It says, while writing about Josiah, who was one of the few good kings of the Old Testament era, Jeremiah says, he judged the cause of the poor and the needy, then it was well. Is this not to know me? Now think about saying, he's not just saying, judge well, be fair to the poor and the needy. He's saying, he judged well the poor and needy. Isn't this what knowing God is all about? Isn't what, in other words, this isn't just a directive, go and do that. This is what knowledge of God is. This should be so in your bones that it's part of your knowledge of God himself, is that this is instinctual to you, that you care and are fair for the poor and needy. And so you see the teaching of Jesus coming out and affirming this all over the place. And as you teach the least of these, my brethren, so you treat me, and so on. So I want to end with five what ifs. And my questions of what do we maybe do to start to redraw the lines? And it's to ask five questions. First questions. What if evangelical Christians who are meant to believe the whole Bible would press one another in their political views to expand their vision to the full range of biblical morality, for the full spread of the moral foundations and the content that's in each of them, without cherry picking? I wonder if it would be different. That would mean caring for a vast range of social issues. Many more than occupy the Christians are on the left or the Christians that are on the right in their certainly extreme forms. That would mean caring for social, racial, economic injustice, as well as creation care, as well as medical care, as well as strong criminal justice system, education, respect for marriage, respect for family, the unborn, the very old, for people in between the unborn and the very old. For religious freedom, it would mean everything is on the table. It would be wonderful if we were known for that. It would mean challenging both greed and laziness as serious problems. Why shouldn't we challenge both greed and laziness? This would not mean the Christians would be standing all in one place as little clones. But I think if this was true, it would pull Christians in from the extremes of left and right, which would mean less polarization, or less Christian voices fueling that polarization. I think it would pull us in toward the center. We'd never be all in the same place, because there's bound to be all sorts of diversity among us, and that's good, that's wonderful. But it would pull us in. Because people on the extremes don't do justice to the other side. Second question, what if we could resist getting packaged? By that I mean, in the present political climate, I personally don't fit in. I'm pro-life, but I'm also very much for the need of environmental care. That means pro-life puts me with conservatives, so liberals don't like me. Being an environmentalist puts me with liberals, and conservatives don't like me. Being liked is not the problem. That's not what it's all about. But watch out for being put in a package. People, both sides desperately want you in their package. To dot the T's, to dot the I's and cross the T's, and be part of their package in the whole. That's part of the difficulty of the present party system. But I can't embrace either package, left or right. for reasons I've just described. I don't like packages. I think we should think outside of packages. Think of, wrestle through each individual as its, individual issue as it stands. That means we don't fit nicely in any one little box. I think one of the more powerful things Francis Schaeffer wrote for our age, not period, not all of these written, but for our time, on this issue at least, is that he wanted us to be able to be co-belligerent with people who completely disagree with us on other issues, but without having to be allies with them. In other words, to be able to battle one issue or another with people who completely disagree with us except on that issue. He, I think, remember telling us that he was in Spain once and got a discussion with a fascist and a Marxist. And he was hated by one and then the other, alternatively, as he changed sides with what they agreed with. He was holding his position. He wasn't changing anything, but he was saying things that the Marxists liked, and then he was saying, and that the fascists hated, and then he would say things that the fascists liked that the Marxists hated. But he said, that's who I am, and that's what I want to be able to do, is to take an issue at a time and say it as I see it. We can be co-belligerents with people who are not our allies on all sorts of other issues. Third question. What if we doubted our own position? What if we doubted our own position biblically enough to rethink it? To rethink where I might be right or where I might be wrong. I, for one, do not trust either the right or the left implicitly. I just don't. If I lean to the left, where am I on issues at the beginning of, or in the end of life? On the status of marriage, on religious freedom. If I lean to the right, where am I on what the prophet's message is? The care for the disempowered, on corruption, for creation care. I find it difficult. When we go to Europe, Christians there that we know, many of them will ask, how could you be a Christian in America and be a Republican? Most of the time around here, you ask, how can you be a Christian and not be a Republican? Except in our church, which is an African-American church, where they ask, how could you possibly be a Republican and a Christian? You know, I don't want to make it a forced entry, a forced belonging to one or the other. I think we need to think creatively each time and question, could I be wrong in this area or that area? The fourth question, what if we are committed to civility and kindness in all our political discussion? The Bible says, death and life are in the power of the tongue. Our tone can make mutual understanding and persuasiveness a possibility, at least, or a complete instant impossibility, depending on what our tone is, depending on how we discuss, depending on our attitude in talking to one another. Discouraging, was it Maxine Waters, encouraging people to, she's from Congresswoman on the left, and if you see anyone who's part of the Trump cabinet or his team, chase them out of the restaurant, say we won't eat here with you, call people to get the cameras and protest their presence in this restaurant. Anyone has anything to do with the Trump campaign. Feeling she's giving giving them as they've given, but that isn't the way to have any meaningful communication. What if we looked at our own Christian history? That's the fifth question. Evangelical Christians have not always been where they are now. I think of John Wesley, who many of my friends in England say was, because of his work in the north of England, and struggling to help people in the very early days in the Industrial Revolution who are just absolutely abandoned as workers, there started what became the Labour Party in England. And it was, saw the suffering of people making not enough money to live on, getting completely left out as the Industrial Revolution gets going, and stepping in and organizing them as Christians, getting them to pull together and make a better life. As well as being an evangelist, traveling I don't know how many thousand miles on horseback, back and forth, preaching for his whole life. In this country, evangelical Christians were perhaps the driving force behind the whole movement for the abolition of slavery. a deep tradition ingrained in the South prior to the Civil War. Can you imagine that? Evangelical Christians being a major force to undo such a deep entrenched tradition? If you can't imagine it, you need to get your imagination, shake it loose, and realize that that's what they were doing, not to mention people like Wilberforce in England. One of the more influential Christians, evangelical Christians in the late 19th and earliest centuries was a three-time candidate for the presidency and Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson. It was William Jennings Bryan. It was his life tragedy that his last public stage was botching the Scopes trial. But his life is worth reflection. He fought against evolution because he believed it was against the Bible, but also because he passionately opposed social Darwinism, which, with its necessary view of the poor being the least fit, and that's why they were poor, because they were the least fit, and the least deserving of any government help. And so social compassion was foolish because it tries to reverse the process of evolution. So he had a lot of ammunition against evolution because of its tremendously harmful effects against the poor. His ideas of wealth distribution would put him with today's progressives. He fought against the gold standard because the gold standard severely limited the amount of supply, the money supply, made money available only to those already rich and made it difficult for poor people to start businesses. So he was against the gold standard, his famous speech there. He was Secretary of State under Wilson and resigned when Wilson entered World War I. Now, can you imagine such a public Christian today doing that, those sorts of things? Doesn't fit very well. Now, I'm not trying to say everything it was right. I'm not sure how much he did was right, but maybe it ought to be possible for us that someone who's a sincere Christian to be able to do similar sorts of things today. I've always been challenged by a passage in Joshua chapter 5.